Welcome to another edition of the Volunteer State. I'm Blake Topmeyer, alongside veteran columnist and locally recognized author John Adams. On this edition of the Volunteer State, we're going to be taking a look at Jeremy Pruitt's roster that he inherited from Butch Jones as compared to Josh Heupel's roster that he inherited from Jeremy Pruitt. But first, before we get to that, John, the news in the SEC this week is Nick Saban receiving a contract extension that would keep him on Alabama's sidelines through the 2028 season. How big of a deal is this? Is this just, these contract extensions, Saban's going to be at Alabama as long as he wants to be at Alabama. But do you think this is a sign in the aftermath of Coach K's retirement, or announced retirement, he's going to go on a victory lap, that we shouldn't plan on Saban going anywhere anytime soon?
Yeah, I mean, Saban gets that question all the time. When are you going to retire? It's usually asked by fans, hopefully by fans from other programs. I mean, I think Nick Saban's in really good health for his age and for any age, really. I don't know if there's anything physically wrong with him. So he doesn't really have any other interest in coaching football. He goes out to a lake once a year, I think, but that's about it. So, yeah, I mean, let's see. Saban is, how old is he now?
69.
He's 69. In 7 years, it's through 7 years, he'd be 76. Bobby Bowden coached till he was about 80. I mean, I could see Saban doing that.
He'll turn 77 during the final year of this contract. He'd turn 77 before the end of that season. So, sure. I mean, I think age-wise, we've seen coaches go that long. I mean, Coach K is 74. I believe he'll turn 75 by the point of his retirement. So I think in the aftermath of Coach K's announced farewell tour, the thought then shifted to college football's greatest coach. If Coach K is the greatest coach of college basketball's modern era, at least, his counterpart is Nick Saban. But there is a five-year age gap between those two. And although it feels like Coach K had maybe lost a step in the past year or couple years, doesn't feel like Saban is losing any ground. Feels like he's still a step ahead of his peers.
No kidding. And I think after the basketball legend and a football legend gets an extended contract, I think people are probably wondering, well, when's John Adams going to retire?
Yeah, I was thinking about that, John. You know, yeah. Coach K's news conference to announce this final season, I'm calling it a farewell tour, techno music played as he walked into the room, and he was pumping his arms and clapping his hands while the techno music played. Made me wonder, if your retirement ever comes, a thought I shudder to think about, but if that day ever comes, what plans do you have? Will you be pumping your arms to techno music?
No, I would probably sing Elton John's Candle in the Wind. That's what I sang at my wedding in Las Vegas at the Viva Las Vegas Chapel, and that's kind of my song. So, yeah, that's what I would do. I might pump my fist, too, but that's a long way off. I mean, I'm only 72 years old, so.
Right. I mean, much like Saban, you have a contract that runs through the 2028 season, correct?
Well, actually, it's funny you should mention that, but I am just starting negotiations on a new contract, and I can't really talk about all the intricacies of it, but yeah, I think we'll work everything out and all parties will be happy.
Fantastic. Shifting gears, John, away from Nick Saban to Tennessee, the program that has never beat Nick Saban and may never beat Nick Saban. But
well, it beat him when he was at LSU.
Okay.
That doesn't really count now.
That's a good reminder, though. But Josh Heupel might beat some other teams in his first season, and we're looking at the collection of talent, or lack thereof, that Josh Heupel inherited from his predecessor, Jeremy Pruitt, as it compares to what Jeremy Pruitt inherited from Butch Jones. You know, when Pruitt became Tennessee's coach, a narrative that seemed to be pushed pretty heavily by, well, I think some media types and some folks that were looking to sow optimism for the Pruitt era and blame the predecessor for Tennessee's failures, Butch Jones, as these things tend to go, was really playing down the level of talent that Jeremy Pruitt inherited from Butch Jones just would have you believe that it was a program in shambles. And to that point, Tennessee won just four games in Butch Jones' final season. But as we compare it to this situation, it's not like Pruitt left the program in any real great state. Quite the contrary. The program is under NCAA investigation. There was a flood of players leaving for the transfer portal, and Josh Heupel, I think, has a really tall task with what he inherited coming into year one. So compare those one versus the other, John. Who actually stepped into a bleaker roster situation between Pruitt and Josh Heupel?
Really, there's no comparison, although some members of the media were, 2 years into the Jeremy Pruitt era, were still blaming Butch Jones for his problems. The roster that Josh Heupel inherited is unlike that of any Tennessee coach. It's not like any of these teams, any of these recent coaches have inherited a great abundance of talent. But my goodness, you couple how poorly Jeremy Pruitt and his staff developed players with all the guys that transferred. I mean, this is a really, really, you use the word bleak. Well, this is really a bleak roster. You go back and look at Jeremy Pruitt's roster, the first one he had, looking at that depth chart, there's some pretty good players on it. Trey Smith in the offensive line, Jawan Jennings, I guess Marquez Callaway at receiver, Josh Palmer at receiver, Ty Chandler at running back, Shy Tuttle and Kyle Phillips in the defensive line, Daryl Taylor at outside linebacker. Those are all pretty good players. Nigel Warrior actually got better under Jeremy Pruitt, which distinguished Warrior from just about everybody else on the team. But he turned into a pretty good player. The cornerbacks, Bryce Thompson, Alante Taylor, they're decent cornerbacks. So there's just no comparison with what Heupel has to work with. And I really think fans understand that now.
Yeah, and looking at what Jeremy Pruitt inherited, I think a more accurate description in hindsight is that he didn't inherit great depth from Butch Jones. Tennessee was not at the 85 scholarship level in Jeremy Pruitt's first season. And I think the two deep or even down to the three deep, there was a lot of holes there. But to your point about what Pruitt inherited in terms of the top rung, it's starters, Tennessee starters, I think there was talent to work with. I mean, you touched on several guys there. And I think as you compare that, if you just look position group by position group in what Jeremy Pruitt inherited as compared to Heupel, I think almost across the board, I think Pruitt was in a better situation. You look at defensive line, Pruitt had Kyle Phillips, Shy Tuttle, and if we're calling Daryl Taylor, he was kind of a hybrid, but let's call him a defensive edge rusher for the sake of this. I think that triumvirate right there is far better than what Tennessee has right now at defensive line. You move back a layer. Daniel Batuli was inherited by Jeremy Pruitt at linebacker. I think he's better than anybody Josh Heupel inherits at linebacker. Secondary, perhaps that's debatable. Nigel Warrior flourished under Pruitt. He wasn't flourishing before Pruitt's arrival. And I think maybe it's sort of a comparable secondary that Josh Heupel inherits. On the other side of the ball, wide receiver was very well stocked, I think, for Jeremy Pruitt, with Jawan Jennings coming back into the fold, Marquez Callaway, Josh Palmer. I think Heupel has some wide receivers to work with, certainly some talent there here, but I would probably favor the wide receiver group that Pruitt had. Running back, Tennessee, I don't think has anybody that is Ty Chandler's, I guess, level of promise. Ty Chandler never maybe attained quite that lofty recruiting ranking or played up to it. But I think, again, Pruitt inherited a better situation, probably inherited a better situation with Trey Smith as the top offensive lineman as well. So maybe really just at quarterback, I think maybe is the only position that you could definitively say that I think Josh Heupel inherits a better situation than what Jeremy Pruitt did.
Well, at least though, Jared Garantano, who was criticized so often by the fans here, at least he gave Pruitt an experienced quarterback. He had started in 2017, and he'd started more games, for example, than Harrison Bailey started last year as a freshman. And I like this quarterback group better. Don't get me wrong. But I do think Jeremy Pruitt didn't have to decide who his quarterback would be. He at least knew he had a, you know, an up and down quarterback and a guy that maybe had potential at that point who didn't really turn out to be what Tennessee had hoped. But it wasn't as though he was starting from ground zero.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Blake, when you think about it, see, I go back to Derek Dooley when he took over this program. I don't think he had as much talent as Jeremy Pruitt did. I mean, and you could say the same thing about Butch Jones in 2013. I remember in Derek Dooley's first season, I mean, he ended up playing a freshman quarterback at the end of the year. His offensive line was actually pretty good, but the defense wasn't impressive at all. He didn't really have a running back. You know, I think Heupel may have one in Tyon Evans. We've talked about him, the junior college transfer.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's an unknown quantity, so we'll have to wait and see on that. I just think when you think about it, you would have to say that Jeremy Pruitt did more damage to this football program than any other single person. I mean, when you factor in the NCAA violations, which very likely will lead to sanctions, you go back and look at all the other coaches who got fired, who didn't win enough games, but none of them left the program on probation. None of them had left with so many players on the roster fleeing to a transfer portal. Guess we didn't even have the transfer portal then. But, yeah, I just think Josh Heupel is in a very, very difficult situation.
You alluded to this earlier, John, but do you think then expectations are appropriately, have they been held in check in year one for Josh Heupel? Because this is a job that comes with lofty expectations, at times I think outsized expectations, but it does feel like, and again, I think you alluded to this earlier, it does seem like that there is a sense for the challenge that Josh Heupel steps into. I at least think that expectations do seem to be pretty reasonable here in year one going into Heupel's first season. I don't think anybody rational is expecting an 8-win campaign or anything of that sort in year one. What's your sense of what is expected given what we've just talked about, the difficult situation that Josh Heupel steps into here in year one?
Well, it's a different situation than any other Tennessee coach since I've been here. What I sense with the fans, not only are their expectations more realistic, also I think there's more apathy about Tennessee football than it's been in any time I've been here, and I came here in 1987. I just think a lot of people have stopped caring. I mean, they'll still watch the games. They'll still pull for Tennessee. They don't expect much. They've been through this drill too many times. New coach, depleted roster. There's a lot of lost hope here, I think, and it's reflected in fan apathy.
Counter argument to that, though, John, and we may have touched on this in this podcast before, if Tennessee starts this season, let's say 3-0, which isn't out of the realm of possibility given the early schedule. They open with Bowling Green, then they play kind of a toss-up game against Pittsburgh, and then they have Tennessee Tech. If they can run the table in those three and start 3-0, I think some of that apathy that you're sensing, don't you think that the optimism will then flow again going into a game against Florida and that Vols fans, although they might be feeling a bit downtrodden now, will bounce back pretty quickly with a 3-0 start to the season? Because I think it will. I think the hype train, if you will be humming if Tennessee starts this season 3-0.
I don't think it would be what it would have been a couple of years ago or when Butch started. I think because fans are just, to me, more realistic about Tennessee football now. Bowling Green will be one of the worst teams ever to play here. Tennessee Tech is an FCS opponent and a not very good FCS opponent. Pitt's a mediocre ACC team. So you go 3-0, and then you go to Florida. Tennessee fans have seen that movie. I mean, they know how it ends. It ends with a beatdown in the swamp. I think they will be happy if Tennessee beats Pitt. I think mm-hmm. they would be happy about that. But I just don't think a lot of them are going to say, oh, man, this team could be something special. I don't think they will invest the kind of emotion that Tennessee fans have routinely invested in their football program for so many years. I think it will be hopeful but reserved, because beating those teams just means nothing. I mean, they'll probably score 60 points on Bowling Green. Just has a horrific defense. And maybe the same thing on Tennessee Tech. So I just don't really see that happening.
John, I was glad to hear that you have no plans of retirement anytime soon, because it means we can keep doing this podcast on a regular basis, and we hope that our listeners are continuing to enjoy our podcast. If you don't mind, take a moment and give us a rating. We'd really appreciate it. Subscribe if you don't already, and you can always subscribe to KnoxNews.com to keep up with the latest writings of myself and John.
I mentioned earlier my ongoing contract negotiations that I didn't opt for a different role in this podcast. I just didn't want you to think, well, John's going to be angling for more stuff. So you can rest assured this podcast will go on as it always has.
Love to hear it. John, you mentioned the swamp and what you're expecting to be another beatdown in the swamp this year. I guess Dan Mullen kind of had a short-lived time in the SEC headlines last week. He got a bump in salary, and he has 6 years remaining on his contract, which was extended through the 2026 season. And like I said, it was a short-lived time in the headlines, because then Alabama came on the heels of that and extended Nick Saban's contract. But to the point of Mullen, he's now one of the highest-paid coaches in college football. Do you think that's a spot he deserves, a rung he deserves to be at? Is Florida overpaying its coach, or is this a deserved bump for a guy that in year three led Florida to an SEC East division title?
That's a really good question. Florida won national championships under Steve Spurrier, one under Spurrier, and then two under Urban Meyer. So that's what the standard is. But after Urban Meyer, there was a long run, not as long as what Tennessee has experienced, but there was a long run of mediocrity pretty much by Florida standards. And I think Dan Mullen has elevated that. The question about Dan Mullen: did a great job at Mississippi State, great offensive mind, but people wonder, well, can he recruit well enough to hang with Georgia and Alabama? Now, he can out-coach Kirby Smart at Georgia, but he's got to have comparable talent. He can't be way below the talent level. So I think that's still a question about Mullen, and I think the expectations will be for him to win more than 10 games. But I don't know whom Florida could get right now that would be better than Dan Mullen. I mean, Urban Meyer's not coming back. Florida fans need to be hopeful of Dan Mullen that he will upgrade the program. I was impressed by how Florida played against Alabama last year. I mean, Alabama was clearly a superior team. And even the year before against LSU, we're talking about two of the best teams in the history of SEC football. And Dan Mullen had pretty good teams at Florida. He hung in there with those teams into the fourth quarter. And I think that's significant. I think he's close to being what Florida wants him to be and hopes he will be. One other thing about Mullen I've noticed, he's doing well in the transfer game.
Mm-hmm.
He's added, I mean, it had been just wide-scale additions, but he's got some key players, defensive linemen from Auburn, a running back from Clemson, to fill needs. So we'll wait and see this year, but I can see why Florida would have improved his contract and made him an even higher-paid coach.
Yeah, I think the NCAA's changing transfer rule landscape works to someone like Dan Mullen's benefit, a guy who's been a decent recruiter at Florida, but not to the level that Alabama's recruiting or LSU or Georgia are recruiting. I think this transfer rule almost allows you to function as an NFL-style GM. And I think it's a rule that can work to Florida's advantage, because we do know that Dan Mullen is a really good X's and O's coach. He's a good quarterback developer. The question does remain, can he recruit at an elite level for Florida to catch the likes of an Alabama? Well, now he has another avenue to assemble talent, and that's through the transfer portal. This new deal, John, makes Dan Mullen the fifth highest paid coach in college football, and he's the third highest paid coach in the SEC, behind Nick Saban and Ed Ogeron, guys that Nick Saban has won seven national titles, and Ed Ogeron has a national championship to his name. Dabo Swinney is also ahead of Dan Mullen, and Jim Harbaugh is ahead of Dan Mullen. This sends Dan Mullen's salary past Kirby Smart, sends him past Jimbo Fisher. Of course, that can always change. Those guys could get raises too. But to me, when you have to wonder, is a guy worth a top five salary in the sport? The question is, can you win a national championship with this coach? If you can't win a national championship with that coach, he's not worth a top five salary in the sport. And I do think, even though Dan Mullen is 0-10 all time against Nick Saban, you know, all but one of those losses came at Mississippi State, and even though Florida has yet to make the college football playoff under Dan Mullen, I do think that Mullen gives Florida a chance of winning a national championship. And so to me, top five salary based on what he's accomplished maybe is a little bit lofty, but I don't think it's totally out of the realm of where the ballpark should be for Mullen's salary, because I do think, based on what we saw in terms of Florida winning the East in his third season, I know they had some disappointing moments along the way, particularly that late season loss against LSU, but they did win the East. And I think momentum is building for Florida's program. And I think in today's era of college football, in which quarterback play is more important than ever, you know, a guy who has Mullen's track record for developing quarterbacks gives you a chance to contend for championships. So I think in that way, he probably is at least deserving of being in consideration for a top five salary in the sport.
Blake, you can bring up the quarterback development. Go back to Mississippi State with Dak Prescott. People weren't even looking at him as a quarterback. LSU wanted him as a tight end. He was a three-star prospect from Houghton, Louisiana. Then look at Kyle Trask. I mean, this guy was kind of, he was falling by the wayside. And look what Dan Mullen did with both of those guys. I just think that is so important in today's era of college football. It's a quarterback game. And this guy's track record with quarterbacks tells me he can maximize whatever quarterback he has. I think he has two really talented quarterbacks now. Emory Jones, who was the heir apparent to Kyle Trask. He's waited patiently. And then Anthony Richardson, who was a freshman last year, who actually I think is a better pure passer than Emory Jones. Not as good of a runner. But my point is that he's got some more guys he can work with. And you give him enough talent at that position, he will really capitalize on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think Florida will still be competitive under him, and at some point maybe it'll break through. But you know how difficult it is when you're trying to break through against Alabama. I mean, you know, it took one of the best team in LSU history to do that in 2019. It's just so hard to break through against Alabama. It's in a league of its own. That's a challenge for Kirby Smart. I think Kirby Smart will feel more heat at Georgia this season than Dan Mullen will at Florida.
To bring things back to Josh Heupel in Tennessee, John, you know, I look at the landscape of coaches in the conference and where these programs are at. We talked about the roster situation that Heupel inherited as compared to Jeremy Pruitt. I guess kind of a closing thought is the overall SEC landscape that Josh Heupel steps into as compared to what Jeremy Pruitt stepped into. I mean, Dan Mullen was a first-year coach at Florida in the same year that Pruitt was, and he inherited a team that won four games the year before Mullen's arrival. Now, Florida is humming at a pretty high level with Mullen entering his fourth season. Georgia was in a good place when Pruitt came in. It's still in a good place now. Nick Saban, no sign of relenting. LSU, despite last year's, I guess, step backward, I look for LSU to bounce back this year, and I think it's in an overall better place than it was when Jeremy Pruitt became coach. And then you look at Texas A&M. Jimbo Fisher hired in the same offseason as Jeremy Pruitt. I think, you know, Texas A&M is a program that's in a better place now than it was a few years ago. You can run down the list. Ole Miss with Lane Kiffin, Mississippi State with Mike Leach. Point being, I think the landscape of the SEC is, and this is going to sound just, I guess, like a promo for the conference. I really don't intend it that way, but I think this is a conference that is tougher now than it was the day that Jeremy Pruitt stepped into this league. I think it all adds up to just a real monumental task that Josh Heupel is taking on here.
I agree, Blake. And part of it is a roster. The other part of it is a schedule. This first-year schedule that Josh Heupel faces will be more – it will be easier than his next two. I mean, you talk about the programs that are in good shape right now. Look at 2022 when Tennessee picks up LSU. LSU is going to be better than in 2022 than it is now or was last year. So you're playing LSU and Alabama from the West. 2003, you pick up Texas A&M. Jimbo Fisher has that program rolling now. I don't know how good it'll be in 2023, but I think it'll be a top 10 program. And so you combine those two elements, and I just think no Tennessee coach has ever faced a real rebuilding job as difficult as this one, except for Johnny Majors in the late 70s. And it took him a while to get it going. I think the question in Heupel's case is, will they give him time? Because I think his record after 3 years will be, by Tennessee's past standards, a fireable record. Perhaps Tennessee will look at these obstacles that we've talked about and say, we got to give this guy more time. But just the record itself, I don't think it's going to be very good after 3 years.
All right, John, we'll continue to look forward to the 2021 season in the weeks ahead. I don't know if that was much of a looking forward, but we are casting into the future for the season anyway. And I hope when we pick this up next week, you maybe can share some news of your own contract extension. You think that might be possible?
I prefer to kind of keep that to myself and with the company and with my agent, if that's okay. I think you understand that. You just negotiated a pretty sweet deal for yourself, so you know where I'm coming from.
I hear you, John. Ever so humble. Thanks for listening to this edition of the Volunteer State.